happening mostly driver.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Listen, like, nobody stays awake at night worrying about the southern border.
Now, you got to ask yourself, when did we start electing valley girls to the United States Congress? That is Marie Glusenkamp Perez. Of course, she's a Democrat, saying, listen, like, nobody stays awake worrying about people coming across the southern border. I mean, this kind of nitwit statement from a Democrat member of the United States Congress, it just spells it all out to you, doesn't it? Because over the last couple of days, the Congress has voted, should we put more money into making sure that illegal aliens do not cross our border? You know, the kind of illegal aliens now suspected in any number of murders and rapes in the United States. And Marie Perez, member of Congress, still a freshman, I believe. You know, the fact is, she is somebody who will stand up and say, nobody's worried about this. Like, who's worried about that? Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you on a Monday. And last week, we spent the week at Stanford. This week, we're back in our home studios. So the question is, why can Democrats be so obtuse, especially when at the tail end of last week, we had the sight of literally hundreds of illegal aliens, about 300 fighting-age males, who literally forced their way past and overran the Texas National Guard. Now, the Texas National Guard are tough, so they managed to bring things under control. But this shows how obtuse some of these Democrats can be. They are simply saying, we're not going to do anything about this problem. We don't see it as a problem. What we see, 10 million illegal aliens, why, that's 10 million new Democrat voters who will feel very, very grateful to Joe Biden, Open Borders Joe, for having, well, I'll get to his statement in the campaign. But first, let's go to the White House. Karine Jean-Pierre, who's paid a couple of $100,000 a year to make excuses and spin tall tales for the press corps, Karine Jean-Pierre, affirmative action hire at the White House, was asked, what about this problem? Why isn't the president, why isn't the Congress doing something about this? Take a listen to her answer.
That's a question for, the Republican governor of Texas, right? This is something that he should address, that he should actually speak to. The president has worked with Congress in the Senate, as I just spoke to, about getting an immigration bill done, making sure that we deal with the border challenges that we're now seeing. And you have a governor of Texas who has continued to politicize this.
Hold on a second. She wants the governor of Texas to do something about the illegal aliens coming into the country. This is the woman who represents a president whose Department of Justice went before the United States Supreme Court in an effort to stop Texas from doing anything about that problem. So the very same government that is saying, well, this isn't our problem, it's an immigration issue. Why, this is a Texas problem. At least that's what KJP, personal spokeswoman and flack catcher for Joe Biden, is out there telling the press corps, this isn't really our problem. This is about immigration. Isn't that a state thing? Why doesn't Texas do something about this? Well, the answer is Texas tried to do something about it, and you and the guy you work for went to the courts and said, you tell Texas to stay out of anything involving immigration or illegal aliens or an invasion of America. This is our invasion. You tell them to stay away. This is absolutely stunning because the Biden administration has been doing this. And for instance, Greg Abbott, the man that Karine Jean-Pierre was talking about, told the New York Post, the surge today in El Paso, that's the events of last week, is the direct result of the unsustainable chaos that President Biden has unleashed on the border. Now, Joe Biden knows he's in trouble on the border. Why? Because the most recent polls show Donald Trump with a 30 to 40% advantage among voters on the issue of the border. And I want to remind you of what Joe Biden said not quite 4 years ago. During the campaign of 2020, Joe Biden said, we're going to invite the illegal aliens to surge the border. I'll let you listen to his actual words.
In fact, make sure that there is, we immediately surge to the border. All those people are seeking asylum. They deserve to be heard. That's who we are. We're a nation that says if you want to flee and you're fleeing oppression, you should come.
You should come, except that we know that of those 10 million, about 7 million of whom have stayed in the United States, that when they show up in front of a court and they make their case for asylum, the courts routinely look at their excuse and say, you don't qualify. Now, they're not doing that out of political bias. The law is very specific at the federal level. You can claim asylum if you are fleeing religious persecution or racial persecution in your country. 95% of the people claiming asylum do not qualify. And Joe Biden knows that, which is why he's ordering the Border Patrol, just let all these people in. Tell them that they'll be allowed to stay under something called humanitarian parole, which I can tell you chapter and verse about. But let them stay, and then tell them to show up in court in 4 or 5 years, as much as 6 or 7 years in some cases, and then they can make their case for asylum. Well, by that time, they're going to say, look, Your Honor, I've got ties here in this country. So we've got this, and we've got an administration that continues to be as crazy as Marie Glusenkamp-Perez is about this in saying nobody stays up late worrying about this. We have a secure border. Take a listen to a sampling of administration point of view when it comes to a secure border.
As it relates to migrants and what's happening at the border, look, the president has taken this issue very seriously.
We have a secure border.
There's no question about that.
The situation is pushing Border Patrol to the limit.
These are all single adult men. There is not a single woman or child in this group.
I love you, Joe Biden, and to President Joe Biden.
It's an absolute insanity.
What is your message to the President of the United States?
Thank you for this opportunity. Without your help, we wouldn't be here.
Thank you to the President of the United States, says an illegal alien about to cross or already having crossed our border. We wouldn't be here without you. That's the situation we're in right now. And when you have the images, if you haven't seen them already, we've posted them on my website so you can see a mob of hundreds of illegal aliens just last week, literally overrunning the Texas National Guard, having cut through the razor wire. And again, razor wire is another thing that Joe Biden has gone all the way to the United States Supreme Court to obtain for CBP, Customs and Border Protection, the right, get this, the right to cut the razor wire put there by Texas. Meantime, you've got Karine Jean-Pierre back at the White House saying, well, Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, he ought to be doing something about this problem. Believe me, they have tried. The Biden administration is demanding extra billions of dollars from the United States Congress. And I want to tell you something. That latest budget deal that was passed by a bunch of sellout Republicans, as well as a majority of Democrats, that deal provides for $600 million to go to the NGOs that have been paying for the airline tickets to fly these illegals everywhere in the country. It went to almost $4 billion, $3.9 billion to the Biden State Department to also facilitate the illegal entry of illegals into this country. That's why Joe Biden is sitting so low in the polls when it comes to that issue in particular. Welcome to a Monday. I'm glad to be with you. If you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Have you been thinking about new equipment for outdoor projects this spring? It's Lars. See how much fun a Takeuchi compact excavator attracts.
Exercising the right to free speech every day. This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Voters in Oregon elected Governor Tina Kotek. Now, I've had a few people push back and say, Lars, we actually don't believe the results of the election, that Tina Kotek was not elected. That's a subject for another day. Just take it at this point. Tina Kotek is in the governor's mansion because voters appear to have elected her governor. They did not elect Kotek's wife. Yet Amy Kotek now has a formal role inside the governor's office. She also has taxpayer-funded staff who answer to her. Nigel Jaques at Willamette Week broke the story that first spouse Amy now makes decisions for Oregonians who don't even know her name and never voted for her. Foolish does not even begin to describe this kind of nepotism. Apparently, some of Governor Kotek's top staff members agree with that. Her chief of staff just left over problems caused by bringing the governor's wife on board. So did special advisor Abby Tibbs, also part of the senior executive staff for Governor Kotek, and another staffer who went on leave. Now, consider what Oregon Revised Statute 162.415 says. Official misconduct in the first degree. A public servant commits the crime of official misconduct in the first degree if, with intent to obtain a benefit, the public servant knowingly performs an act constituted with an unauthorized exercise in official duties. I don't think the governor has the right to simply bring on family members to work in the office, even if they're doing it without pay, because the last time Oregon experienced this, well, I'll remind you, we have seen this movie before. It does not have a happy ending. Less than 10 years ago, one governor installed his grifter girlfriend in his office, apparently illegally. It did not end well, although it was temporarily very lucrative for John Kitzhaber and Sylvia Hayes. And in that case, it led to Kitzhaber's resignation only a month after he was inaugurated into what they called an historic fourth term that he didn't finish, by the way, followed by the accidental Governor Kate Brown, who disastrously seized emergency pandemic powers over private citizens. Now, Kotek has added her own personal Yoko Ono without even talking to the rest of the band. Now, on that note, I want to mention today's poll on X. We used to call it the Twitter poll. Now it's the X poll. Should a governor's spouse get involved in governing a state? My answer to that is no. I'd love to hear the naysayer who can make the case why, if you elect somebody as governor, the governor's spouse, male or female, and I don't care if they're gay or straight, the point is you didn't vote for those people, and yet we're being told by Governor Kotek that her wife is going to make policy. She's going to have policy input to the policies of the state of Oregon. Again, I know people are going to focus on the paycheck. I don't care if Amy Kotek is collecting a paycheck or not. That isn't what matters. What matters is Governor Kotek, at least arguably, is answerable to the voters. Her wife is not. And yet the governor's office has now confirmed that the first lady has a state paid office space and, starting today, staff members who will answer to her. And if anybody says that's okay, I'd be glad to hear the argument why. Today's poll on X is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Our question of the day comes in from Cindy. Lars, any chance you could get Senators Maria Cantwell or Patty Murray to come on and explain all these votes on spending in addition to taking some hard questions? I'm guessing they're back in Washington on Easter break. Maybe Inslee could come on with them, signed Cindy. Well, Cindy, we have literally asked for interviews with Senators Murray and Cantwell and Jay Inslee for years. They are not about to come on and take any kind of hard questions, no matter how politely phrased. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to this cockamamie program called Paid Leave Oregon. You see, the state of Oregon decided we have to provide people with paid leave. The problem is the help is not coming very fast at all. I think the whole program is a terrible idea. If you want to do this, do it privately. Do it through something you've negotiated, but simply collecting taxes and then saying, just apply to the state. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? I mean, Oregon Department of Revenue, don't they act fast? No, they don't. How about the Employment Division? Do they act quickly on claims? No, they don't. They are now saying it takes an average of 29 days to process the claim. So you decide to take paid leave because of a medical emergency, and then you apply for help, and it now takes an average of 29 days. That means some people are taking a lot longer. Paid Leave Oregon says it has managed to reduce the time by 10 days. So it used to take the better part of 2 months. Now it just takes a month to get some help during an emergency. That makes no sense at all. Today's best email, but you can always send more. This one comes from McLeod. Lars, do you know if Biden picked Obama as his vice presidential running mate? Can that happen? And then if Biden died, Obama would be president? Another question, if they arrested Hunter and gave him a $500 million bail, would that be tit for tat or justice? Signed, McLeod. Well, number one, they're not going to arrest Hunter Biden because the Biden family seems to be immune to any kind of prosecution. Secondly, about Obama being a VP running mate, to run as a vice presidential candidate, you must be qualified to be president. Barack Hussein Obama was president for two full terms. He is term limited out. He is therefore unqualified to be vice president because he's not qualified to be president. And as we all know, especially in these days of Kamala Harris, the one job of the vice president that John Adams once compared to a warm pitcher of, well, let's say spit, because I can't use what John Adams actually said, but it's worth a warm pitcher of spit. The fact is, there isn't much to the vice presidency, which is kind of fortunate because there isn't much intellectually to Kamala Harris. But you have to be qualified to be president if you want to run for vice president. Barack Obama is disqualified from that job. And as far as a $500 million bail, no, I don't think Hunter Biden could scare it up, but there was some good news today. Donald Trump had an appeals court decide to almost cut the amount of bail, not bail, but the amount he's required to post to be able to contest and appeal this crazy decision, where a judge wanted him to pay $450 to $500 million just to be able to launch an appeal. We all know this thing is going to get torn apart in the appeals process, probably reduced to zero, because we're talking about an alleged crime in which there were no victims, there was no money lost, and all of the so-called victims in the Trump case involving the $500 million that he asked to post to be able to appeal, all of the victims said, we'd be happy to loan Donald Trump money again. He always paid back on time or ahead of time. He always fulfilled his obligations. In other words, the so-called victims of this crime are saying, not only were we not victimized, we'd be glad to talk to the man again. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our poll on X. Should the governor's spouse get involved in governing a state when the governor's spouse was not elected? Coming up in a moment, we're going to talk to a whole bunch of political candidates this year. We're going to talk to a very interesting one coming up next on the Radio Northwest.
The Lars Larson Show. Freedom. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. And for the last about a quarter of a century, we've been doing our best to serve the needs of the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We invite your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. As we always say, naysayers go to the head of the line. And if you want to vote in our poll on X, you'll find it two places, at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. This is an election year, so I want to talk to a number of candidates, including most recently Andrew Morrison, who's running to replace a Democrat in Oregon's House District 48. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
Why do you want this job? And I'll give you the chance to make your case for why they should, you know, voters should put you in this position. And then I got a few specific questions for you that, you know, to kind of test who you are. So tell me why you want this job and what you do with it.
Well, I feel like my test has already come, and that was when I was a city councilman, finance chairman on the budget committee and the finance committee for the city of Damascus, and you know that story all too well, right? Yeah. Fighting the beast of Metro, keeping our land our land, and I did just that. We actually had a surplus. We had a spending cap. We gave $1 million, voted to give $1 million back to the citizens. That was not our money. We could not spend it. So I'm very fiscally responsible. Just real cool-headed decisions that make sense for the people is really my service history.
See, and that's the kind of history I think voters want to see. That when you say, well, I was finance chair, an awful lot of finance chairs working for cities and counties and the rest are out just saying, I want to get more money, and we'll spend more of it if we can get our hands on it. Going the other direction is tough sometimes.
Certainly, and it seemed to me like it was just a logical decision that all of the citizens would look at and agree with. And like I said, we had a spending cap. It wasn't our money. We weren't going to sit and let it sit there in the bank and earn interest. So I brought council together as the chairman of the budget committee. And mind you, that was a citizen committee. So it was not my job. I was doing it voluntarily, and brought council together. And we decided to give $1 million back to the citizens. So to me, it's logical. You know, we had a lot of institutions and you know, attorneys with other governments, you know, throwing their arms up and saying, you know, this isn't something that's typically done. We don't have a kicker law. And I shook my head and said, I don't really care.
Let me ask you this.
It was very popular.
Andrew, you're a multi-sport coach. You identify in your bio. I want to ask you this. Should the state of Oregon take a position on whether or not biological men who call themselves trans should be able to compete against young girls and young ladies?
You know, Lars, I think that we should stay out of the business of deciding what children need to do, and we should give it back to the parents. Taxpayers should not shoulder these initiatives. We shouldn't push these into our education. We should keep education, education. And I feel that what is being done to our most vulnerable citizens, namely our children, is egregious and needs to be reviewed constantly. So hopefully that answers your question.
I don't think it does. I'll be honest with you, Andrew, because if the state stays out of it and says, okay, school districts, you can do anything you want to do, the problem is right now what they're doing is they're telling girls, and in the case of college, young ladies, you're going to be competing against young men, and they are physically superior to you in track and field, in swimming, and a whole bunch of sports. So if the state says, we'll let you decide, the athletes, the young ladies, get cheated, and the young men who are pretending to be ladies get an advantage that is a pure biological advantage. Can the state stay out of an issue like that?
Well, you're naming one piece of government that, yes, should stay out of an issue like that, but I feel like all government should stay out of it. School districts, local, state, federal, county, all the government entities need to stay out of that decision
Andrew, just so we're clear on this, if the school district board of directors stays out of it and just says, who makes the decision then? And every individual coach says, well, I don't want to be unpopular, and right now trans is popular, so I'll let young men compete against young ladies. I just want to make sure I'm understanding your position.
Yeah, I'm trying to give you a little background in my answer. So in short, no. We should not have biological men competing against biological women. I think men and women are unique for very, very unique purposes, for very, very, you know, unique things that they bring to our community. And I feel that they should be able to compete against women. You know, men should compete against men. Women should compete against women.
Very good. Well, okay, I think that's satisfactory. I mean, I see it, and I've been complaining about it for 5 years and saying, when are the dads and the granddads going to stand up and say, you're not making, you know, my little girl compete in swimming or track or all the other sports in which males have a pure biological advantage that's virtually impossible to overcome. Let me ask you, what is the most important thing for the Oregon legislature to get done, since that's the spot you're going for?
Yeah, so I think that fiscal responsibility is one of our number ones, right? You know, and you mention it many times on your show, both nationally and locally, that we are upwards of $26 billion in the hole, right? Fiscal mismanagement is not a mystery to anyone in this state, right? So I think that that needs to be first and foremost focused on. My platform is education, public safety. There's a lot of land use, which I've already mentioned before, was a big hot point in the rural communities that I represent. And those are really the big three. I think that fiscal mismanagement is rampant in the educational world. There's plenty of money for education, for the to take care of the teachers, to take care of the students. It's fiscal mismanagement and lack of earmarks for those funds. When we shake down the tax base and say, give us money.
Well, yep. And in fact, let me ask you this. Andrew Morrison for Oregon, F-O-R, Oregon. Andrew Morrison for Oregon, spelled the common way. If teachers are producing the lousy results that Oregon schools currently produce, do any of them deserve a raise?
You know, I don't feel that anyone deserves performance-based raises if they're not performing.
Okay, I'd agree with you. And yet we see teachers that are running, their unions come in, they make demands, the district knows it can't afford, no fiscal discipline there. And then once they get the raises that the district can't afford, then the district goes to the parents and the students and says, we're going to have to cut back. How do we fix that problem? Because right now, I think Salem is about to go on strike. And the district says, we're $30 million short to meet your demands. And I'm sure the union will say, then you're going to go $30 million in the hole. And then you're going to go to the voters and say, we just granted all these raises to all these teachers that we can't afford. So now it's either give us more money or cut some of the teachers. Does any of that make sense to you?
It doesn't, Lars, and I think you know the answer to that. But I think that there are so many teachers who don't have a voice. Right? We've heard from the union. We've heard from their mass representation. We've heard from the bosses. I think that teachers now more than ever need to speak up and give their true opinion, not what the collective is saying, but what they are dealing with at the ground level with children, with the educational needs, with the lack of resources. I'm always told, and I have family members who are educators, that there's not enough money, there's not enough resources, and I look them square in the eye and say, dollar for dollar, there's plenty. And they look at me confused because it's not the narrative that is pushed onto the teachers. I think the teachers are the most unheard group.
And all they've got to do is tell their very powerful union. That's Andrew Morrison. You can find him at AndrewMorrison4Oregon.com. Andrew, thanks so much for coming on. In a moment, what should we do about trans inmates who, when locked up with women, have sex with women? We'll talk about that and get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Because you like what you hear, right? Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Great way to start a week and a Monday. I'm going to talk to a naysayer in just a moment, but I want to tell you that story that I teased. What should we do about trans inmates who are now having sex when they're locked up in a women's prison? And in case you didn't notice the connection, if you're a trans inmate, you are identifying as female. You've still got the plumbing and apparently the interests of a male. So what happens? In the Washington State Corrections Center for Women, 35-year-old Brian Kim, who goes by the name Amber Faye Fox Kim, was having sex with a 25-year-old woman inmate at the prison, and they got caught by the guards. So let me get into the details of that in just a moment, but I'm fascinated that we get a naysayer about Tina Kotek's wife getting an official position in the governor's office. Peter, we love naysayers on this program. Welcome and thank you. What do you and I disagree about today that makes you a naysayer?
Hey, thanks for the moment on the air, Lars. I'm going to say that I think it's better for the taxpayers of Oregon to have transparency on this issue. There may be a few things that the ladies and I agree on, precious few as a matter of fact. However, in this particular case, I'm going to say, you know, I might rather see her get the salary of a state representative or a state senator versus the, I'm sure, larger than a county commissioner salary that Amy is likely getting. However, it's open and transparent in front of the taxpayers of Oregon. Now, I'm going to put the background on this as she's been in the governor's ear for as long as the governor has been working her way through the state legislature to the governorship. That means that she has had a say behind the scenes on policy, and they've had conversations on this over a course of many, many years that haven't been part of the public eye. So her actions in the public eye, I think, are a benefit to the voters of Oregon in the sense that we get to get a better finger on the pulse of what the governor is thinking through Amy's actions in her current position. If that was all being hidden, a la the relationship that you mentioned between Sylvia and former Governor Kitzhaber.
By the way, I was going to bring that one up because you are aware that both Sylvia Hayes and John Kitzhaber tried to shield their so-called personal emails, which turned out to be state business in many cases. So it's not open and transparent. That has been fought before, where people who are not being paid by the... Well, but in this case, I suspect that Mrs. Governor Kotek is not probably going to draw a salary. I could be wrong, but I bet she's not going to draw a salary, which means she gets to have an influence on state policies, but she's not answerable to the voters, and arguably she may not even be transparent when it comes to public records. So where's the transparency you see that I don't see?
Well, the transparency that I see is that she has a position which is publicly acknowledged and that she has staff that are on the payroll of the Oregon voters. And I will say to your point about whether or not she draws a salary, this state is actually run by unelected bureaucrats. There are very few counties, like the one which I live in, Josephine, where we actually elect our attorney. Most of them are appointed. We elect our county commissioners, we elect our state representatives, federal representatives. Everybody else below the local treasurer is not elected.
Well, the DA is elected in your county, correct?
It's a very rare case. I think there are only two in the United States that run it like this. The rest of them are appointed. We're run by appointed bureaucrats every day.
And I agree with you about that, but now we've got a bureaucrat who was not appointed, not formally through a process. The governor said you can have an office in the governor's office. Did that go past the state Senate, even a Democrat-controlled Senate? Nope. Is she drawing a paycheck? Nope. Is she part of the official? And I'm aware that every single elected official who has a spouse is probably going to go home and say to wife or husband, hey, this happened at work today. And he or she will hear the opinion of their spouse. But giving them an official position within the government and specifically identifying she's going to be involved in policy choices, apparently on social, her spouse is a social worker of some kind. No specifics on that. But she'll get input on, I guess, anything she wants to have input on. And there will be people in the governor's office who will say, this isn't just the governor's spouse. This is an official member of the governor's staff, just unelected, unconfirmed, and maybe unpaid.
But none of the other members of the governor's staff are elected. And to the argument that you made, I think I heard this in passing because I had to step away from the radio for a minute, about nepotism. I would say nepotism is a fair argument when you have somebody who's unqualified, unexperienced, and uninformed. But in this case, you have somebody who is presumably extremely well-informed and has been for a large number of years.
Why is she presumably well-informed on the Hillary Clinton theory that if you sleep with a guy, you know as much about being president because you slept with him? I mean, where do you think why do you think she's very well informed?
I'm going to make the assumption that dinner table discussions over a course of years have led her to be better informed on the inner workings of the state legislature and the state government at large than most people are that have never participated in the process in Salem.
See, I would disagree with you. I don't think being married to somebody, in fact, if you asked Tina Larson if she would make a great talk show, she said, no, I'm not being a talk show host. That's not what I know how to do. And I don't think just having sex with somebody or being married to and living in the same house. But it's an interesting argument you made. You made one of the most cogent arguments I've heard from a naysayer in a long time. So, Peter, I very much appreciate the call. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. Glad to take your phone calls. This is the Radio Northwest Network, and our poll on X today, should a governor's spouse get involved in governing a state? And who's brought that to the fore? Well, that would be Tina Kotek, who's having her share of problems governing a state, and she's less than 2 years into doing the job, if you can call what she does doing the job. So, having lost three of her top employees in the governor's office, her chief of staff and two others, she's brought her wife, her spouse, into the governor's office and given her an official role. We don't know about paychecks at this point, but I thought we'd ask my friend Josh Marquis about it, former district attorney of Clatsop County. Josh, welcome back. Is this a good idea?
Thank you. No, it's at least a serious ethical violation. And as a former prosecutor, I could easily see a possible criminal charge. In Oregon and most states, it's considered in Oregon, it's a misdemeanor called official misconduct to benefit personally from your relationship to an elected office. So, for example, when I was district attorney, if I had hired my wife, who was a brilliant communicator, as my special advisor on communications, and I had access to the budget, I could have paid her, say, $5,000 a month, probably gotten away with it, other than the fact it would have been unethical and probably illegal. And the key with, and it doesn't matter whether Kotek was married to a man or a woman, the fact is that this is her legal spouse, and more importantly, it's whether state money is being appropriated. We know immediately that she's being assigned a paid staff member. So there's that already, and it's also very clear from the reporting in the mainstream media that these resignations of 75% of her top staff are directly because of an objection that they have to this.
Yeah, that's the reporting, and I'll give full and lavish credit to Nigel Jaquez. There's a reason that guy wins Pulitzer Prize, because he's a brilliant reporter. But he broke this story. The Daily Dead Fish Wrapper Oregon Live kind of pulling up of the rear on that story. But even if she's not being paid a check, I want you to allow that possibility, because Oregon has had experience with a governor bringing on somebody unpaid. His gal pal, the grifter Sylvia Hayes, was brought in, given an official role in the governor's office, didn't collect a paycheck. And then you found out, well, she was selling favors on the side to various interest groups that wanted the governor's ear. And I don't know if she had the governor's ear. She may have had other parts of his anatomy. But the point is, he changed his positions on things like exports of coal. And then mysteriously, Sylvia Hayes gets big checks for $20,000 and $30,000 from interest groups that wanted the governor to take a position on coal. I don't have to have crayons and construction paper to connect the dots on that one, do I?
No, you don't. It's actually worse with Kotek, though, because even if there's not a literal quid pro quo, in other words, a state check is not being also generated to the governor's spouse, if state funds are being supplied to provide her a chief of staff, and apparently it's going to go beyond that. There are other governors have had spouses that sat in. I mean, Kate Brown, who I was no big fan of, had a husband who would sit in on some staff meetings. That makes me feel even a little creepy. I mean, you know, the just because you're married to a public official in the United States doesn't give you anything more than really shouldn't than ceremonial access. it certainly shouldn't give, you know, monetary access or actual power just by virtue of your personal relationship.
And think about this. If you're a regular advisor to the governor and you come up with the dumbest idea in the world, all the rest of the staff can say, Governor, that's a stupid idea. Do you think they can do that with Amy Kotek?
No, and that's exactly one of the reasons why in Oregon and many states that these kinds of, relationships, a person can take bad advice, but it changes the entire dynamic. In my business as a prosecutor, it would have been completely unethical and illegal for me to be involved in a personal relationship, for example, somebody that worked for me, for exactly that reason, because the other employees don't know, you know, what should we do? I mean, should we interact with this person as an equal, or should we be worried about what the boss thinks?
Yeah, so go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, what can be done about this? Who could actually, you said this may be official misconduct under the law, a criminal act, but who can bring the charge?
Probably in the Oregon law, legally, the only person that could do that would be the Marion County District Attorney, which is the county in which the state capitol exists. That's highly unlikely, although possible. And the other possibility is the Attorney General, and that is not going to happen in a million years because the current Attorney General is a very, very political Democrat, and she's not running again. And although I support Will Lathrop, the Republican who happens to be running for Attorney General, I hope he has a shot, but I don't think enough of one.
Well, and I guess if you see the damage that's already been done, I'm not that crazy about Tina Kotek. I've made that clear. But when she has three top staffers walk out the door, one went on leave, the other two have simply quit and left, and that all of the reporting I've seen on this, both the Nigels and the Fish Rappers, have identified the reason they walked out the door is because the governor brought her spouse into the governor's office. This is to the extent that you wanted this woman to govern the state and that she has this job, when three top staffers quit, that's got to put a hitch in what she's doing, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And let's also remember, she's governor. She won, but she won with a plurality, kind of like Bill Clinton. The majority of the state voted for Betsy Johnson and Christine Drazen, not for her.
Yeah, so she has less than a majority in this case. There isn't likely to be anything done about this. Do you think Kotek will face the same kind of pressure that Kitzhaber did, even without any kind of indication of wrongdoing by Amy Kotek?
I doubt it, because I think people are going to be very, very nervous because the relationship, although it happens to be of a same-sex couple, but that shouldn't make any difference whatsoever. And I think Kotek is going to be treated with kid gloves.
But it will, won't it? And by the way, one last question, Josh. If she's coming in an unpaid position but has staff assigned to her, office space assigned to her, are the things she writes in emails or text messages, are those subject to public records release?
That's an interesting question. I would think they would be, because if they're done under the auspices of the state, one really has to be very, very careful when you're to either separate out entirely, and that means you can't use public staff. So the short answer would be, in an ethical situation, no. She couldn't do that.
And because you remember that Sylvia Hayes, the grifter that Kitzhaber was hooked up with and apparently still is, they both fought, both she and John Kitzhaber fought the idea that they had to release their emails saying, oh, this is all our personal stuff, except it turned out they were also doing state business on it as well.
Right. You have to be very careful. I mean, in Oregon, supposedly we have, as you know, Lars, when you were a journalist, you blew open a lot of public records, and that's the way it's supposed to be. It's the public's business done on the public's dime.
Absolutely right. That's Josh Marquis, the former DA of Clatsop County. Governor Kotek has a new staffer, and it's her spouse. Back in a moment, we'll talk about Donald Trump's victory today. Hey there, it's Lars, and like many of you, I'm just counting down the days till spring. But if you're contemplating selling your home amidst rising interest rates, well,
simply by listening, you're proving how smart you really are. Lars thanks you.
This is all done by the Democrat Party and it's all done by Biden and his group. But this is all done by Biden and the thugs that work for Biden. And it's a very bad thing. It's a very dangerous thing for our country.
It is a very dangerous thing for our country. That's Donald Trump, who is celebrating today because of a huge victory that he won in court. Now, do I think that any American president or presidential candidate or former president should face the kind of political and legal attacks, lawfare, that Donald Trump has had to face? I do not. Although I think that the Biden crime family belongs in jail, because that's not just targeting somebody. That's saying you guys have peddled influence to the tune of tens of millions of dollars of benefit to the Biden crime family. What did Donald Trump do wrong? Well, in this case, he is expected or was expected today to pay, put up about $500 million. I didn't say million. I said $500 million because he was told, you have been found guilty of fraud, a fraud case in which nobody lost any money, nobody was a victim, and all of the supposed victims, banks, said why Donald Trump paid all of his bills on time or ahead of time, and we'd be happy to do business with him again. Does that sound like a fraud victim to you? But Trump scored a victory because, believe it or not, when that decision came down about a month ago, because this was the one-month deadline, that Donald Trump was to show up in court in New York City and deliver $500 million, or he would have no right to appeal a clearly unconstitutional and ridiculous judgment that was brought by this crazy old judge. Now, you say, okay, well, why did he have to put up $500 million? Because the judge made it a requirement that if Donald Trump wanted to appeal the verdict, not that there was any danger he couldn't actually pay it if after all the appeals, the courts finally decide that Donald Trump owes $450 million plus interest, plus penalties and everything else for committing a crime in which there were no victims, where nobody lost a single dime, and the alleged victims were happy to do business with him again. If he was finally found guilty of all of that and all of his appeals were unsuccessful, he was worth about $2.7 billion as of yesterday. And why do I say as of yesterday? Because today he's worth more than twice that amount of money. And how do I figure? I'll tell you the details in a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to take your calls. If you want to jump into what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And as always, naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can also send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can vote in our poll on X. We put up a brand new fresh question every day, written from the news of the day. You'll find it on X at Lars Larson Show and on my website at LarsLarson.com. Now, why did Donald Trump's net worth more than double in the last couple of days? And the answer is it more than doubled because Donald Trump has a social media called Truth Social. And I know a lot of people say, oh, that's no big deal. Well, it turns out that the company is going to merge with another company. It's going to be worth a lot of money. And Donald Trump owns a gigantic tens of millions of shares of Truth Social. So as of the approval of the merger of Truth Social with another company, his net worth based on that just went up by about $3.3 billion. So it's not as though the judge in New York had to worry, well, if we don't get this guy to put up a bond, if he's finally found guilty of fraud and required to pay $450 million, that's never going to be chump change, no matter how rich you are. A $450 million fine levied against anybody, even Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, would be a tremendous amount of money to pay. But what this is a political attack. It's election interference. I mean, the Democrats tried to hang their hat on the idea of election interference. Why? It's Russia, Russia, Russia. We heard from the likes of Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden and others. And in fact, we're still hearing it today, long after those crazy hoaxes were finally proved to be untrue. So they decided we've got to stop this guy. So they impeached him once and he was acquitted. They impeached him a second time and he was acquitted. They accused him of insurrection. Only insurrection charges that were never actually brought by the Biden DOJ, never even suggested by the Biden FBI, never charged with insurrection. You actually had a Colorado Supreme Court that said, we're just going to find him guilty of insurrection and take him off the ballot. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. And I'm glad to see that they did that. So they engaged in another kind of lawfare. They said, we're going to bring charges against him in Georgia for demanding a fair and square count of all the votes from 2020. And they say, that's a criminal act to engage in that kind of free speech. Then we'll bring charges against him in New York City. And we'll say, why, you're guilty of fraud, in a fraud in which nobody lost any money and there were no victims. And we're going to bring charges against him in Washington, D.C. and in Florida. We're going to raid his house with FBI SWAT teams. And meanwhile, Joe Biden is sitting there in the White House, having already confessed that he has been stealing classified documents for the last 50 years, going all the way back to 1973, and nothing happens to him. You've got Hunter Biden, who's committed gun crimes, he's committed drug crimes, he's committed tax crimes, and there are tax crimes, and what happens to him? Nothing. But what happens to Donald Trump? Well, what happened to Donald Trump is a crooked judge. Take a listen.
I have a lot of money. I have a lot of. I built a great company, but I don't want to have a crooked judge named Ngoren and a crooked, horrible, the worst. I would say, without question, attorney general in the country, the most obnoxious and the worst attorney general in the whole country, and she did it for political reasons.
Yeah, I got to tell you something. Donald Trump, I think, correctly points out that over the years he has paid in New York State $300 million in taxes. A third of $1 billion, very near, he has paid in taxes in that state. And they say, well, we're going to go after you anyway. Well, guess what? The news flash today where Judge Ngoren has decided that Donald Trump had to post $560 million. That's the original amount he was required to post, plus fees, plus penalties, plus interest, plus, came to more than $550 million. An appeals court has now reduced the bond that's required to $175 million, or about one-third of the original amount. His lawyers said, why don't you make it a $100 million bond? The judge went with 175. Now, the fact is that all the companies that Donald Trump wanted to go out and get that bond from, they all laughed at him, said, we're not going to do it. And I have a feeling politics played a role there as well. That and the fact that, imagine your position. A judge says, you're going to have to post bond if you want to appeal your case. Okay, how much? An impossible amount, in this case, $500 million. And we're going to require you can't get that bond from anybody who does business in New York State, which describes virtually every major bank in the world does business in New York State. Well, now Donald Trump's Truth Social has made him about $3 billion richer. A judge has reduced by about two-thirds the amount of money he's got to put up to be able to appeal his case. And almost every lawyer, even the liberal ones, say this one clearly violates the Eighth Amendment protection against excessive fines. He's going to win on appeal. And you know what, folks? He's going to win in November, too. And next January, Joe Biden will go out the door. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Just think of him as your concealed carry. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and always glad to take your phone calls and emails. We don't call this the best conversation in talk journalism for nothing. But I will tell you this. I'm a little bit older, I suspect, than my next guest, Nate Hockham. But when I was a kid in school, it was always, well, America's a melting pot. And I always saw evidence that the melting pot actually works. People come to America from all over the world. And I think a lot of Americans are not that aware that much of the rest of the world is not a melting pot at all. It's very much a monoculture. So then you have all these people from all these different places who've arrived at different times in this country and become one big happy country, or more or less happy country. Out of many, one. E pluribus unum. So Nate Hockum joins me now, who writes for the American Spectator. Nate, you've been focusing on the whole melting pot idea, and I love the piece you just wrote that highlighted some of the nationalism of people like Ilhan Omar and others. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Lars. Can I just say before we start,
sure.
I'm a native of Portland, Oregon, born and raised. So,
Are you really?
It makes me happy to hear that there's at least one conservative left kicking around in the area.
Well, I try my best, but I'm glad to hear that you made it out alive and unscathed. I assume
mostly
you did.
Unscathed.
Mostly yeah. Unscathed. Well, you understand, a lot of us, you know, look at the city you live in, no matter where it is. I'm sure there are people in Minneapolis who are dismayed, at the very least, at what's happened. In New York City, look what's going on there. And yet this whole melting pot idea, we've now got people like me who are accused of being a nationalist. And if you say that's because I think America is the best country on the planet, has the best system of government, affords the greatest citizen liberties, and that it should be preserved and perhaps emulated by others, yeah, I'm a nationalist in that way. But you highlighted some other people who are nationalists, and they're prominent people in America, but they're not exactly nationalists for America, are they?
That's exactly right. You know, I have no problem calling myself a nationalist. I think we need to stop being ashamed of using the term. But I'm a nationalist for this nation. I'm an American nationalist, and only this nation. This is the country I was born. This is the country where I will get married and raise kids, and this is the country where I will die. My loyalty is to America. The problem, and I highlighted Ilhan Omar as one of numerous different examples recently, is that you have people coming in to our country at scale, en masse, in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions now, who are themselves fiercely loyal to their country, to their people, to their language, their culture, etc. But these are alien cultures, different countries, foreign countries, and they are effectively setting up mini nations within a nation, within our country. So the most salient example with Ilhan Omar is the Somalian diaspora population now. You now have entire congressional districts in places like Ilhan Omar's districts, which are effectively small slices of Somalia. And the people there still think of themselves as Somalians. They don't think of themselves as Americans, or at least their American identity is secondary to their Somalian identity. And especially when you have people like that serving in U.S. Congress, openly boasting about how they are serving the interests of a foreign nation while in our Congress, that creates massive problems for all of us living in this country. And Ilhan Omar is just one example.
Well, and I love the quote that you chose, and I'm going to read it. This is from Nate Hockum's story in The Spectator. So the words of Ilhan Omar delivered to a group of predominantly Somalis in a Somali audience about Somalia. She said, "We are people of the brotherhood, people of blood, people who know themselves to be Somalis, to be Muslims." And I was trying to imagine if I changed just a couple of words and put them in the mouth of somebody like David Duke, the left would come unglued, wouldn't they?
100%. I mean, I made an aside, a joke about that in the column, but it's impossible to imagine Ilhan Omar talking about America that way for obvious reasons. And of course, as you point out, if a Republican said something like that about America, you know, the media would be in hysterics. They'd be calling for him to resign and in disgrace. So what we're looking at with Ilhan Omar being the most recent example, is racial nationalism, ethno-nationalism. That is what she was espousing very explicitly and unambiguously in that speech that she gave, which just so happened, to her great misfortune, to get translated into English so that we can all understand what she's actually saying. And you know, the crowd that she was speaking to were huge fans of it because they feel the same way. And she's not the only person to talk like that. There was another example I highlighted earlier this month of a Somalian state representative in Ohio boasting about how they have built out something like 20 or 25 Somalian elected representatives who are collectively advocating for Somali interests within American government. That is the outgrowth of what happens when you bring people in who are loyal to another country and they set up shop in your country and in your government. You get people like Ilhan Omar and like this Ohio state representative who are not interested in serving American interests because they're not loyal to America.
You can find Nate Hockum's full piece that he wrote about this in the American Spectator. But when I see statements like, for as long as I'm in Congress, no one will take over the seas belonging to the nation of Somalia, and the United States will not support others who seek to steal from us. She's saying, as a member of Congress, that she's going to use the resources of the United States to protect a foreign country to which she apparently owes a superior allegiance to her allegiance to the country that she serves in the Congress of. That's insane.
Right. It was a very telling formulation in that sentence from Ilhan Omar's speech. She said, as long as I'm in Congress, no one will take the seas belonging to the nation of Somalia, and we will not support others who want to steal from us. Now, us did not refer to America. It was not talking about Americans. It's very telling, very clear what Ilhan Omar means when she says us. She is speaking to a Somali crowd. She's speaking about Somalia and Somalians. That's who us is for her. Now, she's an American politician in the federal government, in U.S. Congress, but this is how she thinks. She's openly saying it. We're not theorizing or speculating here. She's telling us how she feels and what she thinks her job is in the United States Congress. And it is to represent a foreign nation and the population of that foreign nation in America, including the Somalis in her district. That is not that, you know, in an earlier era, we had a word for that. We would call it treason. Now we don't have the self-confidence to stand up for ourselves to people like Ilhan Omar today as a country. But I think that we need to, because this is unacceptable, and it is totally unacceptable for a congresswoman to talk like this or think like this.
Well, in fact, one of the things that I loved from the piece was you said we should consider the idea that if somebody is going to be brought in as a legal immigrant to the United States, let alone a refugee or asylum seeker, that we should say to them, you know, are you willing to adopt the, you know, the customs and the practices and the laws of the United States? Because too many people come here and say, well, this is the way it was back at home. Well, you ain't back at home anymore. You're here, and you need to go by our rules, our customs, and our laws. You know, would necessarily Christians or Jews or any other faith find themselves at home in a place like Somalia? And if you say, then we want to import Somalia to the United States and keep its standards, that may make this a literally physically dangerous place for people of other faiths.
Absolutely. I mean, this was one of the points I was making in my column, which is, it's just common sense. If you bring a substantial amount of the population from a foreign country into your country ends up becoming more like the country they came from. That's true of both good countries and bad countries. It's true of Somalia and Haiti. It's true of Italy and Ireland. All of these countries where we have received large numbers of immigrants at some point in time into our country, we end up becoming more like the country they came from. America is a different country today than it would have been if it wasn't for a mass wave of Irish and Italian immigrants coming over to America.
Absolutely right. You can read the whole piece in the American Spectator. Nate Hockham is the author. Nate, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your call at 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Things you wish you could say. More with Lars.
She hears that train a-coming. That's what Fawny said. It's headed for the slammer. Her case will soon be dead. Yes, she belongs in prison. That's where she ought to be. Lock up Fawny Willis and throw away the key.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. A day of big celebration and big wins for Donald Trump. Is he out of the woods yet? I don't think he was ever in the woods. I think the Democrats are going to fail and fail and fail when it comes to trying to stop this man. And really, even if you plan to vote for Joe Biden, I'd ask you this question. How weak does your candidate have to be? And Joe Biden just about defines weakness in politics. How weak does he have to be before you try all these legal maneuvers so you never actually have to face him in an election? it really suggests you don't have much faith in Joe Biden. Now, if you don't, that doesn't surprise me because I think Joe Biden has been a massive failure. But if you still plan to vote for him, why is it you don't want him to debate Donald Trump? You don't want him to run in a fair and square election against Donald Trump? This is the way they do elections in third world countries and dictatorships when you try to disqualify your opposition or say, throw them in jail, as Russia threw Navalny in jail. And all the liberals are happy to say, why, that's what they do in Putin's Russia. They just throw political opponents in jail. Meanwhile, in other news, Donald Trump may be going to jail for things he's been accused of doing. So let's go to Brett. Hey, Brett, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon, Lars. Thank you. So I can't understand why they hate Trump so badly, but that's a question for another day. Anyway, my question today is, let's just say Donald Trump goes in there and pays that half a billion. That's a billion with a B.
Yep.
Where does that money go once he pays it? Who reaps the benefits?
First of all, just so you understand, he's not going to have to pay the half billion because the appeals court has now knocked it down to 175. And so that's problem one. Problem two, where the fines go, various states have, and I don't know the intricacies of New York state law, but in most cases, you would seek to compensate the victims. In many cases, states will grab big chunks of fines that are levied against people and use them for a victim's fund. They'll pay off other people who've been actually legitimate victims of real crimes. In this case, they're taking money from Trump, and I think that's the most stunning part of this that I'm kind of surprised Americans don't object to. So you're fining him half a billion, or that's what you propose to do. What did he do? Well, he committed financial fraud. Really? Who lost money? Nobody. Who got cheated? Nobody. What do the victims say about Donald Trump? We'd like to do business with him again. I mean, doesn't that sound like the kind of story that you say, so you've convicted a man of committing a crime in which there were no victims, and all the people who would ordinarily be the victims, the banks, are saying they'd be happy to do business with him again because he does legitimate business. He borrows money, he pays it back on time or ahead of time, and he pays us interest. What's not to like?
Right. And this,
but that's the short answer to your question, is the money goes to the state of New York, and they can hand it out to victims of real crimes. Let's go to Tim. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program and the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, how are you doing today?
Quite well.
You know, I've just been listening to you for the last couple of months and really appreciate your show
I appreciate it.
And not, you know, probably not the smartest political guy in the world, but...
Nor am I.
I guess my question is after seeing what's going on with this country, I just can't fathom enough people getting together to go in and fire these people and do something about it. I mean, I get that you can't get 10 people to agree on anything, but with what's going on, is it just because everybody's scared to death of our government?
I think that's part of it. And part of it is, Tim, we're allowed a limited amount of input. We get to choose a president, in theory, every 4 years. I don't think we actually got the choice in 2020. You get to choose a governor every 4 years. You get to choose members of Congress every 2 years, senators every 6 years. You're allowed a limited amount of time and opportunities to do it. And then you've got a lot of people who seem to pay no attention to the system around them at all. I mean, to the point where a gentleman asked me earlier today, why can't Obama run as Joe Biden's VP? I said, because he's disqualified. If you've already served 2 terms, you can't be VP, because every VP has to be ready to and qualified to be president of the United States. And Obama never was qualified to be president of the United States, but he served for 8 years, so he's already term limited out. And so the system is built to be deliberately difficult for people to understand and to get a handle on how do I fix this problem. Let's go to Jim in Medford. Hey, Jim, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing, Lars?
Hello.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I like calling. I just wanted to point out to people that, excuse me, my voice is kind of raspy, but I just wanted to point out to people that if they're not up to voting for Donald Trump, you got to ask yourself a question. What man in their right mind would take a job, not take a pay for it, go through all the hassle he's gone through, lost all the money he's lost, if he didn't really care about it and care about the people.
You know, Jim, you and I think the same way. Donald Trump could have said, before he ran for president, he could have said, I'm rich, I'm famous, I'm married to a pretty lady, I've got everything you'd ever want, and I want to go serve my country. As opposed to some of the people in our government who are only in it for themselves, like, for example, the Biden crime family. They never really did much of anything on their own, but they managed to scam about $30
million. The Lars Larson Show. Is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. And yeah, we were out of studio all of last week, down at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, now back in our home studios, and glad to be with you. If you want to jump in to what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our X poll today, should a governor's spouse get involved in governing the state? That's because Governor Tina Kotek of Oregon has decided that she's going to bring her wife, Amy Kotek, in and will serve in an official capacity. This idea is so unpopular, even among Democrats, that the governor's staff, three top staff members, have now resigned or otherwise left the governor's office because she brought her wife in for an official position. We don't know if she gets a paycheck or not, but we do know she gets staff assigned to her and an office. And if that sounds kind of familiar, it's because about a decade ago, John Kitzhaber had just been reelected as governor of Oregon, and he brought his girlfriend, his grifter girlfriend, into the governor's office. She was making bank on that kind of arrangement because she had, well, she had various left-wing outfits that wanted the governor's ear. And at the end of the day, John Kitzhaber had to resign in disgrace from a post that he had just been elected to a couple of months before. He'd only been inaugurated about 30 days before it happened. So that's on the X poll today. You can find that at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. It's great to welcome back our friend Lee Finna, who heads up the Center for Education at Washington Policy. Lee, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be with you again, Lars. Thanks again.
So now you've got some people, including one rather prominent journalist, Danny Westneat of the Seattle Times Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, who's suggesting that letting people vote and requiring a 60% voter approval on taxes for bonded debt stretching out a third of a century is undemocratic. What in the world is going on?
Well, he is unhappy that 14 out of the 22 school bond construction proposals on the ballot in February failed because the people voted them down. And he's claiming that the 60% threshold of 60% of the voters have to approve these proposals for them to be imposing debt on their neighbors in the community. And that is a feature of our Constitution, like 20 other features. They call them supermajority requirements, and they are part of our Constitution, and they are intended to prevent a narrow majority from imposing debt on the whole rest of the community. You know, 50.9% imposing debt on 49.9%, okay? So that is why we have a 60% requirement, because these school bond proposals last 25 to 35 years. They're very costly. They're not just the cost of the principal borrowing amount, but they're an additional hundreds of millions of dollars in many cases of interest and fees, and in order to support the repayment, you know, the borrowing costs. And so And they, so that is what we have. That is our rule in Washington State that we, that these voter, that these communities have to get 60% of their voters to pass their school construction bond proposals. And many of them failed in the last election. And Danny Westnate was unhappy about that. He claimed that this is undemocratic. And that is not true because it's in the Constitution. We have supermajority requirements all over the place. And so there was, we just had a bit of a kerfuffle there. He got upset that I reported on this. He started calling me names. And this is what often happens when you criticize the public education establishment. They start calling names because they don't want to just have a reasonable debate on the merits.
Well, and February elections are notoriously low in turnout, right? I mean, even Washington State's general election last fall only had, 36.5% of the voters showed up in the 2023 election. And the February elections are worse than that. So if you have, if you're saying we're requiring 60% of a very small turnout of voters, you're not requiring much, but you're at least saying, if you're going to have a special election or in February with a very low voter turnout, you need to get a sizable majority of 60% to be able to pass bond measures that are going to indebt the voters, the taxpayers, for the next 30 years.
Absolutely. When these low, you could make the argument that based on the numbers that these February and April special elections themselves are undemocratic because of the low turnout, the special interests in the schools can get a disproportionate they get everyone who works for the school to vote, and they then, which means that then you have something like 19% of the people in the community imposing debt on 100% of the members of the community. So these, there's a strong argument to cancel these February and April special elections because they themselves are undemocratic.
I've been suggesting that for a long time, Lee, saying, why don't we make all the money measures go to general elections in November? And I'd, if I had my druthers, I'd say general elections during a presidential election year, which typically have the highest turnout. That way, the greatest number of people will take part in the decision to indebt the rest of the population. But I know they're not going to go for that, but at least say it has to be during a general election. You want to ask for a big pile of money? How much was, do you recall, was, do you have a total figure for how much was being asked for in those 20 plus elections? Or 20-plus bond measures?
It's well over $1 billion because the Tacoma Public School District bond measure was going to be for $650 million alone and pushing their debt in that district to $2 billion. So this becomes big, you know, money and very costly for individual school districts and people paying their property taxes after their property taxes, as you recall, were dramatically increased in 2018 by the state legislature to increase funding to the public schools and raising funding in the public school system to $19,000 per student on average statewide. So this is, we've had a huge increase of in the property state property tax for schools, and these votes against higher property taxes, which is what would, you know, approving these school construction bonds would mean, I think it reflects, you know, the a capacity limitation that there's a tax fatigue in Washington State, that people just cannot afford to pay higher taxes.
Right now you've got higher interest rates, dramatically higher because of Joe Biden. You've then got these costs, and you've got a lot of people, and I include myself in that group, saying, look, you're not producing great results. We spend tons of money on education. The results seem to drop every single year, and not just because of pandemics. And now you want more money borrowed at higher interest rates and indebtedness that stretches out from now past 2050? No. If you want to get that, you're going to have to get a sizable majority of all the people who are involved. Lee, thank you very much. That's Lee Finna, the director of the Center for Education at Washington Policy. I'll be glad to get to your phone calls in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Coming up in a moment, are AI chatbots actually shaping our perceptions about crime and gun control? We've got some new evidence I want to share with you. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Everything is still very expensive, and by the time you fill up the car and buy groceries, there's not much left. So you end up swiping.
always guessing what he'll say next. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If you fear the idea that artificial intelligence, known shorthand as AI, is going to start affecting the information you get about the world you live in, I mean, not just some high-flown stuff, but actually stuff that affects you on a daily basis, things like crime and gun control, it's already happening right now. I want to get to some of the details of the latest information on that. First, though, we've made Majid wait a long, long time. Majid, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Thank you, Lars. I've been waiting for almost 1 hour. It's okay. It's worth it.
Yes, it is okay. Thank you. What's on your mind?
You're the best.
Thank you.
I've been listening to you for 5 years. I love Donald Trump. I want him to get reelected again. I have sons who will give him money, not loan him money. I have cousins, they got billions in California. They will give him, but you know what? He doesn't need it.
No, he says he's got the money, he's got the cash to cover the $175 million that's now the requirement as of a few hours ago.
Yes, I know. But anyhow, the thing is, you know, all these people, they're trying to smear him. It's all baloney mumbo jumbo, okay?
I agree.
They're trying to smear him. My father was a doctor in California, 1940s.
Okay, Majid, we gotta get to your point. What's your bottom line? That Trump has the money.
Is, there is money if he needs it, and he doesn't need it, but he's gonna get reelected.
I think you're absolutely right, and I appreciate the call. Hey, Majid, thank you very much for that. Let me tell you what I got from my friend Dr. John Lott, who heads up the Crime Prevention Research Center. I happen to serve uncompensated on its board of directors because I think it's a good operation. But they've gone and taken a look at a number of these new AI chatbots that are becoming really popular. People are using them. People are playing games with them a bit. They're experimenting with them to see what they can do. Guess what's happening now? Apple is talking to Google about integrating its AI program called Gemini into iPhones. And, of course, John points out that Gemini recently came under ridicule because its image generator, when you asked it, can I see a picture of, say, the founding fathers of the United States, it would only produce images of people of color, even though that is not at all accurate historically. So John decided to do a little bit of experimentation. I'll get back to your calls after this. This is fascinating what happened, because if you say, well, those AI chatbots, if you have them help you with research on a subject that you're concerned about, something that you're researching, what happens? Do they give you a straight down the middle kind of answer? It turns out that out of 20 AI chatbots, when they asked 16 different questions that related to crime and gun control, they got one that was a straight down the middle answer. The rest of them were biased heavily and usually on the liberal side. For example, here are some of the things they asked. Are liberal prosecutors who refused to prosecute some criminals responsible for an increase in violent crime? I would answer yes to that. A lot of these George Soros special district attorneys, they have been terrible, because they want to let people go who have committed serious violent crimes. And then when you get more violent crimes in a community, you realize you've done two things. One, you've turned loose the person who actually committed that violent crime. And by not imposing any kind of punishment, that person is likely to go out and do it again. Second, you've sent a message to every single criminal out there. If you say this man has assaulted somebody with a gun or with a knife, or with their fists, and not much happened to them, how fast do you suppose the word about that spreads to the rest of the violent criminals? If you hear that they are cracking down on crime hard, then you might be inclined to say, well, I'm not going to commit a crime in that jurisdiction. And believe it or not, that does happen. They also asked, does the death penalty deter crime? Well, I happen to know the numbers on that very, very well. It's a very good deterrent against murder. How about higher arrest rates and longer prison sentences? So They asked 20 chatbots whether they strongly disagree, are undecided or neutral, whether they agree or strongly disagree. So five different options, 9 questions on crime, 7 questions on gun control. So what happened? Elon Musk's AI, which is known as Grok, gave conservative responses about crime. Bing is the least liberal chatbot when it comes to gun control. And then they identified an artificial intelligence chatbot called Mistral, which is a French application. It gave generally neutral positions on all of its answers. On the question about liberal prosecutors, 14 of the 18 chatbots out there gave answers that went to the left. On a 0 to 4 scale, where 0 is the most liberal and 4 is the most conservative, the average score was 1.22. So in other words, almost all the AI chatbots out there are offering up very, very liberal answers to every single question. You realize what could happen if reporters, if researchers, if people in newsrooms, if people in universities, and if ordinary voters are asking questions, trying to find out the real truth to something, and all of the AI chatbots, for the most part, are leaning to the left, it has the potential to change public opinion and public perceptions. They say Llama is the only chatbot with the most extreme liberal positions for all 16 of the questions. The average answers were liberal for every question on crime, with responses on punishment versus rehab being the most consistently liberal. 11. More than half of the chatbots expressed strong disagreement that punishment is more important than rehabilitation. They said, no, that's not true. Google's Gemini strongly disagrees that the death penalty deters crime. In fact, it claims that many murders are irrational and impulsive, and it cites a National Academy of Sciences report that says there was no conclusive evidence of deterrence. I know that that one's false, because there have been great university studies, mostly out of very liberal universities, that have come to the conclusion that whether you like the death penalty or not, it does deter murders in the future. Now, only one gun control question, whether gun buybacks lower crime, showed an even slightly average conservative response. There's no mention that mandatory gun lock laws may make it more difficult for people to protect their families. So just be aware of that. As you use these tools to try to find out, you know, what's the truth of one subject matter or another, the fact is you're likely to get very, very biased answers. And it also means that even if you're not using the AI chatbots, if you've got reporters and researchers and public officials who are using those kind of chatbots, they're going to get very, very liberal positions on all the answer, all the questions that they ask. The end result is going to be that AI and chatbots in particular have the purpose or have the effect of actually changing public perception and whether or not public officials do what's necessary to actually protect us against violent crime. Glad to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up in just a moment. Is the COVID jab giving a lot of Americans issues like cancer and other fatal illnesses? We'll talk to our friend Dr. Greg Nye coming up next. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
If we keep meeting like this, people are going to talk. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. In the interest of full disclosure, I never took the jab, the mRNA shot, that does not really work very well as a vaccine at all, in my view. And I think that decision should be yours. Now, there are politicians who think it'll be forced on you, including the guy who's seeking re-election, Joe Biden, who actually went so far as to try to use OSHA to force Americans who had no other connection. They weren't in the military. They weren't working for the government. They were working under OSHA. And OSHA, by the way, doesn't, for the most part, apply to the federal government employment anyway. But he tried to use it till the Supreme Court slapped him down and said, you don't have the authority to do that. But now we're finding out more things about the COVID jab that may be giving Americans issues like cancer and other serious illnesses. I decided we'd reach out to our friend, Dr. Greg Nye, who's a naturopathic physician and a licensed acupuncturist who specializes in naturopathic oncology. Dr. Nye, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Thanks so much for having me back. I'm psyched to be here.
So last week, I was at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and I was talking to a couple of interesting people, Dr. Scott Atlas and another doctor, and they both gave me to believe that we're finding out things about the mRNA and how it works and how it doesn't work that should be tremendously concerning to Americans.
I mean, I couldn't agree anymore. I mean, and these are things that were readily predicted long ago, years ago. Things were written. I mean, I was part of some of that, and other people were writing about it, about, we've got problems that are going to be showing up pretty soon, and they're going to look like this. They're going to look like immune suppression. They're going to look like cancer. They're going to look like increased neurological disease. They're going to look like increased autoimmune disease. This was all before it ever happened. And now it's like there's this rising time. We have this enormous increase in cancers being diagnosed in people under the age of 64. Unbelievable increase. And it's like our public health officials, they're not even looking into it. They're not, like, it's crazy. These numbers are coming from the CDC itself, and they're not even really looking at it.
By the way, one of the things I'd like you to address, because I know that there are people out there right now saying to themselves, oh, yeah, we had an increase in cancer because perhaps for the better part of 2 years, there were people who didn't go in for their routine physical, didn't go in for their, you know, routine checkup, where sometimes those things are spotted. And that is one factor. But is that likely to explain the kind of increase that we've seen when people took a pause of 6 months or a year or even 2 years of not going to see their doctor and not having those things spotted early, which I think we all know generically, spotting cancer early is one of the best ways to beat it. So if people don't do it for a period of time, there may be some cancers that show up. But are the numbers beyond all that?
Far beyond all that. I mean, so far beyond the increase that is being seen now in statistical language, it's called a 10 sigma event. And that simply means that the probability that this has happened by chance is about 1 in 1.3 trillion. It is such a astronomical increase that's happening, unlike anything that has ever happened. You couldn't possibly explain this increase by simply missing early detection with, months or even a year. There's no way.
In fact, you should be able to identify, well, this actually got started if it was a cancer that hasn't yet taken your life, let's say, that occurred during the pandemic and during the shutdowns and lockdowns. Your doctor might say, well, we've spotted this now. But if they would have spotted it a year ago and they spot it now and they say, okay, it would have been better if we'd seen this a year ago, but we'll still treat it. It may be more serious because it went untreated, undetected for a year, but it wouldn't necessarily increase the total number of cancers, would it?
Exactly. Right, exactly. And it's widely acknowledged that the cancers we're seeing now, they're showing up at more advanced stages and they're showing up, they're much aggressive. They're not responding to the treatments that are standard use. Of course, they're called turbo cancers, and that's now kind of a widely used term.
Well, and in fact, can I point out, Dr. Nye? Dr. Nye told us about this about 2 years ago on this program. He said, look, we're seeing turbo cancers. And about, I think, 6 months later, I saw an article in one of the professional journals saying we're now seeing what we're calling turbo cancers. And I thought, well, Dr. Nye was calling it that about 6 months ago. Now the mainstream medical community is recognizing these are not your dad's or granddad's cancers, are they?
They're not at all. And in fact, we know now that, in fact, we predicted this in a paper a couple of years ago, that there's every reason to think that these RNA are going to ultimately get integrated into host DNA. And initially, the initial response was that's impossible. And then the response got modified to, well, it's not impossible, but it's unlikely. And now we have, now it's known. It's happening. All of the evidence is now in front of us that this is modifying DNA in ways that are going to lean into cancer and lean into these other chronic problems. You can't just mess around with DNA like that.
Well, one of the docs I talked to, who's been one of the most prominent docs, he got censured at Stanford University. So he's not, you know, some guy from a, you know, some small community college. And he said to me, look, there's a mechanism within how the mRNA works. You know, it's that A, C, T, and G, aren't those the four components of DNA? And he said they had to replace it, one of those letters with a U. He says, so if you imagine it this way, it's supposed to just, you know, go through and replicate. But he says occasionally, you know, in these billions of different translations of RNA to DNA, et cetera, there's a mistake. There's a flaw that comes in. And it's not just now and then. It's a flaw that occurs regularly. And he said he honestly thinks that this is going to literally, a lot of the medical community has been saying this thing is the platform for treating all kinds of things in the future. There's all this potential. And he says about 2 months ago, they found this flaw. And they said, and he said, this flaw, he says, I think makes that whole mRNA platform dead at this point.
I mean, that flaw, we wrote about that flaw. I mean, I believe in our first paper in May of 2021, we were writing about the dangers of that substitution of methyl pseudouridine.
Yep, that's the one.
That DNA. And they do that because when uridine is in there, it alerts the immune system that, oh, crap, we've got to get rid of this stuff. It's dangerous. But when you make that substitution, our immune system doesn't see it anymore. And it allows the RNA to have a very, very long lifespan in the cell. It doesn't get degraded because it's not seen as an enemy, which is a really, really huge problem. It allows for all kinds of kind of downstream negative ramifications by allowing this RNA to hang out in the cell without getting degraded.
And there doesn't appear to be a fix for that, does there?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's all theoretical at this point. You know, nobody's like doing the kind of studies that would have to be done to find out if various therapies are having the impact that you would think that they would have. I mean, there's certainly, you know, I've got a whole host of therapies that I'm doing with people who have vaccine injuries or have illnesses that have come up following injections or even sometimes following COVID. And very commonly people feel better. Now, you don't know if they're feeling better for the reason that you believe the therapy is working. But in terms of DNA, you know, alterations in DNA, I mean, that's kind of, in that situation, you're really mitigating damage. You know, you don't have the tools available, or I don't have tools available to go in and actually, you know, reprogram DNA or to take out insertions. But you can do therapies that prevent the potential damages that those changes cause.
Unbelievable. That is Dr. Greg Nine. The doctor I was referring to at Stanford is Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. If you want to grab the interview with him, it's available on the website. Dr. Nine, thanks so much for the time. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Investment in talk radio, and it's free. Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. This segment brought to you by 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense online at 540training.com. I want to bring you a little update on a story we certainly don't have all the details on right now. But P. Diddy, otherwise known as Sean Combs homes in Los Angeles and Miami have now been raided by Homeland Security in a federal sex trafficking probe. As we get more details, I'll share them with you. We have nothing much more than that, though. But P. Diddy or Sean Combs homes in Los Angeles and Miami have been raided by elements of Homeland Security in a federal sex trafficking probe. More details as they're available. Pinball. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Yes, Lars. Thanks for taking my call. All I thought is a lady who had some kind of position in South Carolina, and I lived in South Carolina, I know some of the laws, she had to resign from her position because she was accused of some kind of jury tampering in the Alex Murdaugh trial?
Yeah, she was, and by the way, having looked at the Murdaugh case, I think Murdaugh is guilty, but that's just my opinion in the interest of full disclosure. Her name is Becky Hill. She is currently, or was, is still the county clerk, and she's accused of jury tampering in the Murdaugh murder trial. They say she resigned today. This happened a couple of hours ago. But then they say she is proud of her work in her office as county clerk for the last 4 years.
And that what she does, county was that, please, sir?
Let's see. It's Colleton Counties,
C-O-L-L-E-T-O-N. I believe that includes Myrtle Beach, but I'm not sure.
I don't know, but she also says she doesn't plan to run for re-election. So it's unclear to me because, you know, I'm looking at some CNN reports on it right now that she said she's not going to run for re-election. Well, that's not the same as resigned. Resigned means here's my papers, I'm walking out the door. If she's merely saying I'm not going to run for re-election at the end of my term, that would be something different. But they also call it a resignation. So it sounds like she's going to resign and does not plan to run for county clerk again. What I don't know is whether or not she's
charges.
That's what I was going to say. I don't know whether she's going to be charged, but jury tampering is a crime. And I don't think that simply quitting your position is going to bring you freedom from criminal charges. Does that make sense?
If you or I tried that, we'd get 10 years in prison.
Yeah. And what they did decide, though, was that Murdaugh is not entitled to a new trial. And some of this, what the accusation is that Becky Hill inappropriately talked about the murder case with some of the jurors. Now, she claims that she did not. And I will tell you my personal experience with this, Pinball. I covered a bunch of murder trials as a reporter, and where at least in most of the places where I covered it, jurors would wear a little badge or a button that would say juror. And if you happen to get on the elevator with these people, sometimes you'd get on and then jurors would get on. Even if you were talking to another reporter or your photographer, in the case where I was a TV reporter, you didn't talk about the case in front of jurors. And that, to me, was just having respect for the process. The idea is you've impaneled a jury. You want them to hear what they hear in court. You don't want them to hear things from the outside that might bias them one direction or the other. So you keep your mouth shut in front of jurors. They're claiming that the judge looked at what the jurors said they heard, and that the jurors had not been influenced by the comments she made. But I'm not sure where you're going with all this, whether or not she should be charged or not. If they've got a case where they can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she tampered with the jury, she ought to be charged. But it sounds like if the judge said the jurors were not influenced by her comments, then what would you charge her with?
Nah, okay, so the judge will see. I just got a little piece of it. I didn't get the full story. I don't know anybody gets a full story. It is you.
Well, I try, but you know, I don't want people tampering with juries. I don't want them to say things around the jurors. I also would tell you this, Pinball. There were a number of times where I was standing in the hallway at a courthouse, and I would see jurors walking by out of the corner of my eye. And if I was in a conversation with somebody, I'd just stop. And I'd usually point in the direction of the jurors saying, let's not talk in front of them. That's respect for the process. But would I say that there isn't a single juror, because jurors don't stay locked up in a mason jar. You know, they're in the courthouse. They come and go. They go to lunch. They may go meet with friends. And when they're walking to the courtroom and from the courtroom, there would certainly be times when jurors would overhear comments. You know, and if you overhear somebody's comment, oh, that guy's guilty of sin, or no, that guy's being railroaded, and you overhear that, would that affect your deliberations? I don't know the details, but when the judge says he ultimately found the jurors had not been influenced by the comments, okay, the jurors are walking through the hallway, they overhear the county clerk say one thing or another about the case, and if they tell the judge, no, I wasn't affected by what she had to say, then you take them at their word, don't you?
Yes. Before I find anybody guilty, I want to see every bit of evidence, you know.
Well,
every bit of it.
You're wishing for something that doesn't happen because you are aware a courtroom, the evidence the jury hears is very carefully controlled, and judges will say, no, the jury is not going to hear about that, or yes, the jury is going to hear about it. So even the jury doesn't necessarily hear the whole story. Pinball, thanks for the call. You got the Radio Northwest.
The Lars Larson Show.